You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio 96.5 FM in Sarasota. We're also streaming live at WSLR.org. My name is Emily, and my guest today, it's really an honor to be talking to Bud Hopkins, who is a certainly well-renowned UFO researcher and has been doing this for many, many years, and in fact is a pioneer in the field. Bud's actually just released a new book. It's his memoir called Art, Life, and UFOs, which gives a really fun and interesting background into Bud's life as an artist, which is how he started out, and then led into researching UFOs and abduction cases. So, Bud, good morning, and thanks for being on the line.
Well, thanks for having me.
But a place to start, perhaps your book. It really is fascinating. It's a wonderful read. I really, really enjoyed it. It's just nice, easy to read. You cover so much. Very interesting to see how your life started out. You had, in fact, polio as a child. And the young adult, you then progressed into becoming an artist and were involved with the abstract expressionists movement and all those different artists you met and worked among. Tell us how all this led up to the UFO situation and you becoming involved with that.
Well, Emily, the thing that's most important is that I had absolutely no interest or knowledge about the subject of UFOs. It was simply not on my radar. And I was just making my art, and I was married, and life was going along. What happened in 1964 was I had a UFO sighting in the daytime. This was on Cape Cod. I was with my wife and a friend, who incidentally was from the UK, and the three of us were going to a party in Provincetown, driving along, and it was about 5:15 in the afternoon, so it was in August. So it was a, you know, completely clear day. There had been a storm or clouds at least earlier in the day, and small clouds were sort of scudding across the sky, but there was almost no problem seeing anything in the sky. And sort of simultaneously, we all saw this object. It was very hard to understand what this might be. It was from the high ground when we were driving, you're on a sort of, it's a place called High Head, and then you go down to almost sea level right away. But on the high ground, we were looking at it more from its edge, and it was lens-shaped. It seemed to be a sort of a dull aluminum kind of surface that wasn't really super shiny or anything like that. And it was apparently just still, or perhaps it was moving up very slowly. Very hard to tell because we were moving, and of course the clouds were moving. Small clouds, and we started discussing what is that thing, you know, and that, what we're all looking at it, and the interesting thing was a cloud passed between us and it and blotted it out for a minute. This is a very small cloud, and then passed along, and then another cloud moving quickly passed behind it and silhouetted it, and a third cloud kind of swallowed it up, so it looked like we could see a shadow inside the cloud, like a ship in the fog. And then as we're going very slowly, obviously, and we're trying to figure out what this was, and as we went down the lower ground and we're looking up more steeply at it, it looked circular. And from underneath, it was off to our left. We still didn't know what it was, and I'm speculating at some kind of a balloon or something stable. And I don't know, I was probably going about 10 miles an hour in the car, and we're all kind of hanging out looking at it, and suddenly the thing shot off, not at extraordinary speed, but say the speed of an airplane, and it went into the cloud bank, into the wind, which sort of smashed up the idea that this was a balloon. And at that point, we got out of the car, and we watched it go, and somebody said, is that one of those flying saucers you used to hear about or something. So anyway, that's how the interest started. Now that was 1964. That's rather a long time ago. So that's how it began. But it took a while before the interest solidified, and I began doing investigations. And so that was took another 11 years.
So at that point, when you saw that, you were still just actively working in the art community. You were actually quite successful in the art community. So you had that sighting and then continued on with your life. And then you said about 11 years later, is that the point when you became interested again?
Yeah, well, that's when an even more crucial event happened. And that's when a man who owned a little liquor store right across the street from me, an elderly man, very gruff and very no-nonsense, with whom I had never discussed either art or UFOs, began to tell me one day, he said, I don't know what the world's coming to. He said, a man can be driving home and something could come down out of the sky and scare you half to death. And that's what alerted me, and I began to hear the story. And this was a case of his driving back to New Jersey across the Hudson River. He lived in an apartment complex that was roughly across from 86th Street in Manhattan. And I figured out where this incident took place was about a mile from Broadway. So much for the idea that these things always land in somebody's pasture, you know. But at any rate, this object passed his car, as he explained it, and landed ahead of him and in a playing field. This is at 3 in the morning, roughly. And these little figures got out, and they started digging soil samples very quickly, very methodically. He was absolutely terrified, and they got back in. He's never seen anything like this. And he said he was finally about 60 feet from where this incident took place, where the thing had landed. And the thing took off incredibly fast. He said he'd never seen anything like it. And he went home terrified, actually. And he told me that he actually didn't turn the lights on in his apartment because he was afraid that they were out there, whoever they were, and they would see where he lived. I mean, he was really so frightened and said he wanted to pull the covers over his head.
Now, at that time, was that the first report that you'd heard of where people said they physically saw beings come out and sort of dig around? Was it mainly at that point just sightings of disks in the sky?
Well, for me, I had begun to read after my original sighting in 64. I began to read about it, and I read about occasionally similar things happening, landings and soil sample takings and so forth. But they were reported very infrequently. So this was a pretty new thing, certainly to me. In terms of anything that I'd ever personally heard about. And I knew this man. Well, at any rate, the basic point here is that when I went back with him to look at the site, and this was 10 months later, he wasn't just gabbing about this thing. When it happened, he didn't tell hardly anybody because he was so frightened by it. And so when finally he told me about it 10 months later, I went back with him to look at the site, I realized that this had all happened in front of a building, an apartment building, which is ironically called the Stonehenge Apartments, of all things, I had been to that building a number of times, a number of years before, because a collector of mine commissioned me to do a large painting for a wall in there, and I had to measure and get the painting in and so forth. But anyway, when we found what were the traces of the holes where the digging evidently took place? There were all these little holes, and they had been filled in, but the point was there was no dirt there or any roots or anything. We found later the man, the park attendant, who had filled them in. But here I had a situation where I was sort of oddly involved in it to start with because of having been there before. And what ultimately happened is when I got back to the scene, I went to the apartment knowing there was an all-night doorman, and he would have seen something going on in the park if he was alert at the time, even though it was 3 a.m., and ultimately found the man who was the doorman on duty that time, who described seeing this UFO with lights on it. And it's a very complex story, which I told in an article that I, first thing I ever written about this, that was published in the Village Voice, a newspaper in New York.
And you also go over it quite in depth in the book as well. So you had that experience. Now, at that point, is that what really got you motivated into researching more cases?
Yeah, and that was essentially the, if there was a trigger before, this was the real trigger. The sighting I had just led me to have an intense interest in the subject and read about it. But this was something was happening, as it were, in my own backyard in New York, and it involved a landing and figures getting out. What I had seen on the Cape was an object in the sky. But this was something far more amazing. And, of course, I had dual witnesses from different points of view. So,
Did these sightings of the witnesses, did these people get any attention from the government, or did they just brush them off?
Well, see, first of all, nobody reported it to the government. The man, George Obarski, who was the liquor store owner who told me originally about that incident, he was so frightened he didn't tell anybody about it. I think he told one relative or something when it happened, and he just happened to tell me because it sort of bubbled out of him. He wasn't about to report it to anybody, and when I interviewed the doorman, he had reported that only to a police officer, a police lieutenant who lived in Stonehenge Apartments. And I was able to contact him, so I was able to verify that even at the very day this thing happened, it had been reported unofficially to a police officer. So as far as I know, there was no government interest. Nobody came knocking on my door wearing trench coats or anything like that, nor did this happen, I think, to George. What I think is very important to realize is that these things, these UFO events, are so frequent that there would be no reason for any kind of government interest in that particular incident I've been talking about, because they probably got 10 more that same day in different parts of the country. They don't have to worry about the rarity of these things to look into them.
But when you say that you initially had no experience particularly or interest in this, as you started to get into the UFO research, were you initially very skeptical?
Well, I had been skeptical from the beginning, in the sense that I didn't think there was anything to UFOs. I was paying no attention to it. Now, when this happened, I have to say, when I had my sighting, I was 33 years old. I was hardly a wet behind the ears child, and I had lived a number of years without anything like this intruding in my life, and my skepticism at each step of the way was in place. I mean, I think that this is something that's not really well understood, is that when UFOs were first seen, they were actually seen and reported during World War II, and we thought they were German. Nobody, secret weapons. Nobody thought, oh boy, extraterrestrials coming to visit or something. And when things were seen flying around, such as the thing that I witnessed on Cape Cod, nobody thought that there was somebody inside of beings. That would have been too science fiction-y, and so I never thought of something of that. I thought it was some kind of equipment or, like a satellite or something. And when this incident happened with George, I had heard about a couple of abduction cases, which I, in my reading and study about these cases, that's the Betty and Barney Hill case and Travis Walton and one or two others, I had become more willing to accept the idea that there were such things as abductions, that not only were there people inside these objects that were sighted, but they were not leaving us alone. So at each step of the way, the information I was getting and the data sort of widened my view of what was possible against the general wall of skepticism that I had.
Now, you mentioned Betty and Barney Hill. I know in your book you mentioned that you ended up becoming good friends with Betty, but initially, what was your reaction when you met her and she told you her tale?
Well, the thing was, when I had my sighting, there had been nothing even in popular culture, literature, anything about abductions. And when her abduction case, she and her husband, when that case was described in a book by John Fuller, but first it was excerpted in Look magazine, and I read it, I thought, oh, this is just too much to believe, you know, to accept. So I was very skeptical at the beginning with her and with the case. And the chapter that I've written about this in my new book, I called the chapter Erosion of Doubt. And that was really what it was, gradually being eaten away by facts, by data, by reports. And so by the time, of course, I got to know Betty, which is, I think I first met her in 81, I had, of course, accepted the case as being legitimate.
So I've read the Betty and Barney Hill story, and there are also people and some sort of ways of thinking that these are somehow our governments doing these things. Is that an idea that you've ever thought is possible from all the research you've done?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the idea that the government is doing this, these things have been reported by pilots and so forth in the air flying right next to American planes, airliners and everything. If we had something like that, if the government possessed a weapon like this that could make these right-angle turns without slowing down and had unbelievable speeds, so that would have been used in war. It would have been used. We've had a lot of wars since these things are reported, and it would have been used economically. Imagine if you could get from the East Coast of the United States to the West Coast in, say, 2 minutes. The idea that we possess anything like that is just totally ridiculous. And, of course, UFOs have been reported sporadically back into the 19th century. So certainly President Grover Cleveland or President Herbert Hoover or something did not possess something that could do this. So government involvement in this subject as being the cause of this. And there's one sort of nutcase in the field who insists that all abductions are being carried out by the government. This is just a kind of homegrown paranoia that unfortunately is very rife in the United States.
But a couple of things I found really interesting when you're describing the abductions is that in some instances you said the people have a memory of something pleasant. Like there's an instance of a little girl and she remembers seeing a very beautiful mystical deer. And mm-hmm. then there was the famous missing time. And you gave the idea that that was probably, rather than the aliens letting her see them and being absolutely terrified, they implant a pleasant memory.
Yeah, I think that there's absolutely no doubt at this point that there is some kind of ability the aliens have. And incidentally, I use the term alien as a simple term. Alien doesn't define what anything is, and it simply defines what something isn't. You know, when I go to Mexico City, I'm an alien. When the Mexican comes here from Mexico City, he's an alien. So it just means what something isn't. So it's just a handy way of describing the UFO occupants as aliens. The point is that we know from so many cases that they have some ability, semi-magical, as it would seem, to control people's visions by putting imagery in their minds, that things that are not there are being cloaked somehow. We don't know how any of this is accomplished, but somehow this can be something they can use to make especially with children, I think, to make them see something that's a little more pleasant than what is actually going on and what they actually look like.
And how often do you find that that occurs?
Like well,
in
most
of the abduction cases?
Yeah, I think in most of the abduction cases, there is some degree of control in that sense. For instance, so many people describe being, of course, enormously terrified when the incident starts. But then when they're taken into the ship, they begin to feel very calm, like everything is going to be okay. That's not in every case, but in many cases. And, of course, one would imagine, just using common sense, that if such a thing happened and your car is stopped and you're paralyzed and you're taken out of the car by these weird-looking figures and you're taken into this landed craft, that as you go in, you would be even more terrified because you would think, you know, obviously maybe you're going to die or you're going to be taken away for good or something like that. But to realize at that point that you're feeling calm, I would say would strongly suggest that they are able to control even your rational thinking and your thought, your emotions.
But at what point did you go from just getting people who had reported a case and talking to them to actually doing the hypnotherapy or the regression? And how much difference did that make to your research?
Yeah, well, those are two very good questions. The first thing is that when people began reporting these missing time cases and so forth, or even details of abductions, which is what started happening as soon as my article appeared in the Village Voice and I started doing radio programs such as the one we're doing right now. People began to contact me and out came these cases with missing time periods where they would remember the beginning of the incident and then the end. They might even find themselves in a different place at the end than they had been in before with no memory of what happened in between. So that's when we started using hypnosis. But for the first 7 years of these investigations that I did, I was taking these people to therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists who were doing hypnosis for me. Sometimes as a favor, sometimes because they were curious and interested. Sometimes I actually paid people. And so I had a 7-year apprenticeship of watching different people doing this hypnosis. And I was very aware that certain clues would emerge under the hypnosis session that I was sitting in on, and those clues were not being followed up because the person doing the hypnosis did not know that much about the field and about the kinds of events that happen and in what sequence. So finally, when I started doing it after 7 years, doing it myself, and incidentally, it's very, very easy to relax a person into a trance state if everybody's very willing to do it. So that isn't the trick. The trick is then how the unfolding of the incident takes place and what questions you might ask. So when I started doing it, I think I was able to get more material quicker than with people who did not know much about the field.
Now, there's always the argument that hypnosis can be led by the hypnotherapist. Do you find that the majority of the abduction cases are very similar, or do you get really differing accounts a lot of the time?
Right. Well, essentially, there are many cases where, and cases that I worked on, where the person doing the hypnosis did not have any kind of acceptance of the idea of UFO abductions. They were doing it just to see what was going to emerge. And out came these same accounts, which are extraordinarily similar and down to very tiny details from case to case to case. So if you're dealing with a skeptical hypnotist, which of course was the case way back with the Betty Barty Hill case, the very first one that was looked at in great depth that way, and the skeptical therapist was not able to lead them into some sort of thing. I'm also, when I'm doing my hypnosis with people, I use an issue of sort of false leads, which I'd rather not explain too much because it's too useful. But the point is, there are ways in which one can make sure that what one is getting is an honest answer, which is not terribly encrusted with the material the person is putting into it, himself or herself, the subject. The details that are so similar from case to case are what, of course, support the reality of the experiences, along with, of course, the emotional reactions.
Now, what do you think, Bud, of there's so much now out there, the excitement about 2012 and the Mayan calendar and so on, and there are people who claim that they're in contact with extraterrestrials, beings from other planets, and they're these wonderful, enlightened, loving, caring beings who just want to help us. In your experience of all the regressions you've done, have you found that to be the case, or does it always seem to be where they're just snatching people for whatever experimentation and then returning them?
Right. The idea that there are people reporting these experiences as a positive, reassuring, and so on and so forth, I think that's generally wishful thinking, coping mechanisms and so forth on the part of the subject. Who would want this to be what it seems to be, which is that we are helpless when these abductions take place, and the whole thing is extremely frightening, and the beings themselves are being described as cold, emotionless, objective. There's no sense that anybody's reporting, in my experience, reporting the beings as being somehow evil, like they're just out to create pain and terror and so forth. That doesn't seem to be the case. Nor does the opposite ever come out, that they're really loving and wonderful and they're trying to help us and so forth. This seems to be done for themselves, for their own particular program that they have in mind. And it doesn't seem to be something that at this point we can read as either something to help us, that does not turn up, or as some sort of evil stormtrooper invasion. That doesn't happen either. But people are very anxious to try to turn this into something more pleasant, and you can understand why.
You mentioned quite a few instances of women who have been pregnant and suddenly lost their baby, and some of them have reported to you during regression that they've been taken back to some kind of craft and they've been shown their child, which is a sort of human alien hybrid. So from that, it would seem like perhaps there's some kind of hybridization program going on.
Well, that's the sense that we get as in terms of the motivation, the reason why these events are taking place, is that it seems to be, and this is of course the wildest, most science fictiony thing you can imagine, but it seems to be that they're trying to create a mixed race or species or whatever you want to say, of beings that look like us, and can actually pass as being normally human, but which essentially contain the alien gift of mental control of other people and their ability to apparently dematerialize and pass through surfaces. All of the things that the small gray aliens can do seem to be embodied in these what we think of as a sort of a hybrid group. Now, we don't know that's, of course, a very, very frightening idea. It took me a whole book, Intruders, to describe this, so I don't want to go back over that now, the evidence for this. It just comes from case after case after case. So that seems to be what they're intending to do, but we don't know, of course, what these beings that they're creating are supposed to do.
But have you found, or do you believe that it's possible that there are any extraterrestrial beings actually living and commingling with us, and that we're not aware of it, and they actually have such a human form that we don't know it?
Well, at the risk of losing whatever audience is listening to us, I have to say yes, I think that's quite possible, and there's a lot of evidence in support of it, as if there's a kind of infiltration going on. And we don't know what that means in the long run. But I do think that I've written quite a lot about that in my fourth book, which is called Sight Unseen. And Dr. David Jacobs, my colleague and friend, has written a great deal about that in two books, one The Threat and the other Secret Life, which implies that there are beings who are beginning to live and mingle.
And do they seem to be higher up, like in positions of government?
Well, none that I've run into. The cases that I've run into that are very suggestive of sort of these hybrid beings living amongst us, there are not too many of those cases I've run into, but they're very persuasive. And these are not people who have any kind of a position of authority, as far as I know. But, just you know, at this point, after having gone through so many stages of dealing with this subject, where I would be saying, oh, well, that can't be. And then it turns out to be true or in existence. And then I would have to say, well, the next thing can't be true. At this point, I don't know where this all ends. But right now, I don't know whether anybody's in some position of authority.
But going back over abduction experiences, it's obviously, as you've described, very terrifying. Someone's physically taken from their location and, in it seems like in most cases, subjected to some kind of tests, which are usually invasive and sometimes painful. A couple of questions on that is, how common or how large of a percentage of people do you think that's happening to? Is it worldwide, or does it seem to be like in certain locations? I know there are lots of reports from, or documented cases from places like South America for some reason. I mean, that would be the first question on that, is how common do you think this actually is? I know I've heard that if it happens to a person once, it tends to reoccur to that person throughout their life. And also, what kind of effect does that have on most people? Do most people have somewhat clear memories, or are most people traumatized by it, or do the majority of people just not even have any awareness of it?
Well, you've asked quite a bundle of questions.
Yes.
Let me start first with, whether this is worldwide or not. You mentioned South America. The first thing is that I've gotten reports from all parts of the world, and I've dealt with abductions that took place in Tokyo or in Italy, one in Rome, you know, cases in Paris, around the world. And the thing is that many countries have no kind of press interest in the subject or scientific interest in the subject. And many places, of course, are the government is very repressive. And so there's nobody to report something like this to, so we don't hear reports. And one time, I was giving a couple of talks in London, and one skeptic said, oh, this only happens in the United States, or sometimes in England because it's an infection that passes around, but it doesn't happen in the rest of the world. It's just an American some American craze. And I said that no, it was worldwide, and described the problem of reporting and so forth in many parts of the world. And when I gave my second talk, he rejected that. When I gave my second talk, I entitled the talk, "There Is No Child Abuse in Iran." And I said, dare anybody in the audience to come up with a single case of child abuse in Iran that they know about. But we know lots about such things in England and Ireland and the United States. And, of course, needless to say, nobody's going to hear about an Iranian child abuse case under the repressive regime that exists. The thing is, it is worldwide. I mean, I've got cases from all over the place. In terms of numbers, percentages, it's just very hard to tell. Now, in 1992, David Jacobs and I were commissioned to do a survey, try to discern what the percentage might be of people who were having these experiences. So it's a long, complex story, but we did what's come to be known as the Roper poll, Roper being the service, polling service that we had do this. And what we had was a number of questions, 11 questions, not one of which described or announced itself as having to do with alien abductions. And the questions were administered by Roper to thousands of people. I believe 6,000 people was the sample, which is huge. And it was basically called Unusual Personal Experiences. And what we had were some camouflage questions having to do with, have you ever seen a ghost, or, you know, one thing or another. I even had a trick question where I made up a word. And the question was, does the word condent seem to have some special or secret meaning to you? And that was to rule out people who were just saying yes to these things, you know. But we did have hidden away five questions which dealt with signs that a person might have had abductions. And we decided that if somebody had reported four of those, then it would seem that that person is likely, or certainly, possibly or probably, a UFO abductee. And we found that about 2% of the sample said yes to four out of the five symptoms. And one of the symptoms, for instance, that we included was, have you ever seen unusual balls of light in your home or bedroom that you could not explain? Now, that's not something that's an everyday experience, but it is something that happens very often with abductees. And people were saying yes to that question, along with three others out of the five. And if the percentage that turned up, it was 2% of the population, which was, of course, in the millions. It was not any kind of answer we expected or wanted, obviously. But it did suggest that whatever anybody thinks, the phenomenon has to be more widespread than could possibly be imagined.
Right, and 2% in the grand scheme of things doesn't sound like very much, but as you say, when you multiply that by the world's population, that's actually a huge quantity.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, 2% of the, just imagine 2% of the population of London or New York. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're dealing with millions, not necessarily of those two cities, but of an area. Millions of people, and you also asked a question about this, or mentioned that this happens again and again to the same people. And this is, of course, something else that I discovered and wrote about in my first book, Missing Time, because the assumption was always that this whole business was so incredibly rare that it happened to somebody who just happened to be like Betty and Barney Hill, on the wrong highway at the wrong time in the middle of the night, and they were a likely target. But, of course, what we found out is that this was happening again and again to the same people and started in childhood. And it just suggested that they were a kind of an involuntary specimen in some ongoing program.
And, okay, so the question of how do most people cope, or do they have control of it? How does that work?
Well, that's, of course, the question that I've spent many, many years attending to. And that is the fact that many of these people, depending upon how much they consciously remember, and let's get this very clear, there are many people who remember practically the whole incident consciously without any kind of hypnosis or relaxation or anything like that being administered. They remember the whole business, but many people manage to somehow take whatever parts they remember and sort of putting them aside as if it must have been this, it must have been that, maybe it was a dream, maybe it was whatever. And, of course, naturally, as with any kind of very, very difficult emotional experience, as these things are, some people handle them much better than others. But the general thing is that people that I'm dealing with very, very frequently are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, huge problems sleeping, problems of trust, problems of being able to trust their own bodies, relationship problems, and so forth. And as one psychologist said, these are exactly the problems one would expect emotionally, psychologically, if these people had in fact gone through these experiences. So it is a very difficult thing, and part of helping these people through the experiences when I'm working with them is trying to find ways for them to cope and to handle the things with less terror and less emotional scarring. But the emotional scars are inevitably there.
I've also read where you said that you found a lot of abduction cases those people have then gone on to have issues with phobias, bizarre phobias, and also addiction problems.
Yes, that's true. The addiction problem is essentially, I think, a coping mechanism. In other words, many people have said, I just turned to drugs or drinking or something because I was just too afraid to face going to sleep at night. Because many of these experiences take place at night. Many, but far from all. A huge percentage take place in daylight and daytime. But the phobia issue is extremely interesting to me because I began to discover that some of the people I worked with reported very odd, unusual phobias that were very, very powerful. And to give one example, when I incidentally examined the phobia, when I asked him about it, I pushed very hard to use some false leads and so on. But a woman was once telling me that she was absolutely terrified of snakes. And I said, well, that's a legitimate thing. I mean, they're poison snakes and you can be killed by one. And they're also kind of creepy as in the way they move and so forth. And I said, imagine that in your worst case scenario, you imagine a snake slithering towards you as if it's going to bite your leg, something like that. Now, that's a strong lead. And the woman said, that's not the way. I said, well, maybe you have this terrible fear that you'll be walking under a tree and a snake will drop on your shoulder. See, I'm just trying to use some heavy-duty suggestions. No, she said, it isn't, that's not it. And I said, well, then just tell me in your mind's eye or the worst case scenario, how do you see this snake? And she said, well, it's looking at me. She said, it's just staring at me and it's eyes. That's what I'm so terrified of. Well, of course, very few people have ever had a snake sort of looking at them in that same way. It sort of devolved as we explored the situation into a case where this really wasn't the snake she was afraid of, but somehow the shape, she said something about the shape of the head. Well, what this seems to have been is some sort of, a cover story or some kind of screen memory that had been implanted in her head. But the thing is, when you go through some of these phobias, for instance, one woman said she had a terrible phobia of, when she was a child especially, of going higher in a building than the third floor because she was afraid that she'd fall to the floor. And I said, you mean you're afraid the building will collapse? And she said, no, And she said that just I would fall through the floor. And I said, well, how would you fall through the floor in a building that isn't collapsing? And she said, well, I somehow knew that I could go through a wall, and that if I could go through a wall, I could maybe go through the floor and fall. Now, nobody I can think of would say that they could go through a wall as a child and be therefore phobic about going too high in a building, unless perhaps that person has actually gone through a wall, which is what happens in some of these abduction cases.
The incident about the snake is very interesting, because going back to what we talked about earlier, where a pleasant memory or impression would be implanted, so the reverse, it seems, can also be true. So that would almost act as some kind of control mechanism.
Well, it might be. It's very hard to know how these phobias, the formation of phobias is sometimes a little hard to get at, and so whether or not this was deliberately placed in their mind or not, I don't know, or whether the person made that association, or maybe the person associated the shape of the head and the funny eyes with the snake, like it's a snake-like being or something, and did it herself in this case. It's hard to know, but some of these phobias are extremely unusual, and therefore they're just very, very hard to connect with an actual legitimate phobia that somebody might have, of terror of mice or something. That's very common. But at any rate, this is just one more sort of clue when I'm doing interviews with people who may have had abduction experiences. This sort of can be an indication that either, I mean, if there's absolutely no phobic issues, that works against the idea that there's a possible hidden abduction. It's not being remembered consciously. But if there are these phobic reactions, sometimes we do get the suggestion that they're kind of a clue about a hidden abduction.
But have you had many cases where people seem to have had, like, physical implants put in the body? I've heard of that occurring quite often.
Yes, well, we do run into this, but the situation is a little ambiguous, because some objects have been removed from under the skin of say, the hand or the arm or something. Dr. Roger Lear has been working on this, and these objects are unusual, but they don't seem to have enough about them now which scientists would say demonstrates that they're definitely non-terrestrial, that they cannot have been produced here. We don't seem to get that from these objects when they're being removed. Part of this that I find most compelling is when you get cases where people describe things that are inside their skull, objects, and I have a couple of sets of x-rays that demonstrate that there is, in fact, a three-dimensional metallic object in the brain. And, of course, in those cases, it's the location that lends weight to the idea that these things are really unusual. Something that's removed from somebody's arm or hand, the skeptics will say, oh, well, it was just some piece of tin that they got in their body when they were kids or something, whatever, even though that's not really what happens when these things are examined. It isn't just some totally everyday object. But the thing is, with these things that are buried inside the brain, the question is, how did that thing get in there without leaving a scar or being some terrible accident? So I do think that these things, these implants, so-called, do happen. I don't think there's any doubt about it. We don't know how frequently, but they seem to be put in place. And, of course, the big question is, what are they there for? What are they doing? And that's another one of the major questions that we don't have any answer to.
But when, in the cases where people have had the implants removed, has there been maybe an alleviation of stress or trauma that they seem to be living with?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I haven't dealt with many people myself that Dr. Lear's worked with, but I'm sure that once the thing is removed, the person will just very naturally feel better, like no longer that thing, whatever it is, it's no longer in my body. So I'm sure they would feel better just as, for that matter, somebody who's walking around with a piece of shrapnel in their body from World War II or whatever, or some Vietnam or some war. If that thing is removed, they would probably also feel better. But I don't know that there's any kind of cause and effect about their emotional world that would be somehow magical or connected with alien intentions and abilities.
And you can hear the second part of this interview with Bud Hopkins in 2 weeks' time. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next time.